with important consequences, as we'll see as we move along through our discussion of Egypt here in the next little while. Now, a very distinctive Egyptian form of kingship emerged. As I said a moment ago, called Pharaoh. Now, this comes from the Egyptian words per-a-ah, which means the great house, the big house. The Pharaoh was the guy who lived in the big house. Now, there's something very interesting hiding in this. We might, any given night, hear on the television news, we might read in the newspaper that the Oval Office reported yesterday. Downing Street says that. The Quai d'Orsay issued a bulletin. We have learned somehow to differentiate a person and an office, and to think of abstract and symbolic ways of referring to an office. We differentiate, for example, between the president and the presidency. The one an office, an institution that is durable, the other a person who momentarily holds that office. In the very fact that the Egyptians called their rulers the guy who lives in the big house, we see for the first time this interesting separation of office and holder of office. The idea that an office can be understood abstractly and symbolically. This is a development which, again, will be with us through the rest of our lectures, but it is something that emerges here for the first time, at least as far as we know, in Egypt. Now, the Pharaoh was basically the person assigned responsibility for guaranteeing Egypt's prosperity and security. In an interesting way, it was pretty easy to be Pharaoh in early times. The Pharaoh had one job. He had one really important job. He had to make the sun rise every morning over there in the east, and he had to make the sun set every evening over there in the west. Well, as far as we can tell, Pharaoh did a pretty good job. So this didn't generate a lot of distress. It didn't generate a lot of trouble. Egypt, as I mentioned a moment ago, was largely isolated from foreign invasions. The Nile floods predictably and benevolently. The land was prosperous. The land was peaceful. Life went on. There was no reason to challenge the way things were. So security legitimized the Pharaoh, and the Pharaoh legitimized the security of Egypt. In many respects, we can take the three great pyramids at Giza, the pyramids of Khufu, Cheops, and Menkaure, as symbolic of this Old Kingdom period, this early period. Now, from one point of view, of course, these are astonishing feats of engineering, built by people who hadn't had an opportunity to come and take engineering degrees from modern universities. The Great Pyramid, for example, is almost exactly 481 feet on a side. It's aligned only a few minutes off true north. It has stones, some of them weighing up to 20 tons, that have been moved very high up. Now, you may be thinking, am I going to tell you how they built the pyramids? Well, no, I'm not, because we don't actually know. There are lots of theories, and I could take up much of the rest of your life going through these theories with you, but I'll spare you that. The fact is, they built them. Let's just leave it at that for the moment. What I want to do is draw an historical fact out of it, and that is, you see, that almost certainly these pyramids required teams of thousands of men years and years to build. Now, this is a remarkable commitment of human and material resources to a particular project. And what is that project? To make a tomb for a king. To make a tomb for a king. That king has to be very popular. People must be very loyal. That society must have the opportunity to commit such resources to a project like this. That's the interesting way, it seems to me, in which we can think about what those pyramids represent, about the stability, the harmony, the peace, the security of Old Kingdom Egypt. The Middle Kingdom is rather different in a number of ways. We generally date the Middle Kingdom 2025 to 1786 BC. This is a period of more widely dispersed rule. In other words, it appears that sort of up and down the Nile, pharaohs were now increasingly required to share power with local notables. Who would those local notables have been? Almost certainly major landowners. In other words, we're finding a certain amount of social and economic differentiation up and down the land of Egypt. Something for which, again, we don't have very good sources. We can't easily say precisely why some people began to be wealthier, more powerful, more influential on a local basis than they had been formerly. What is clear is that these people were less and less willing to sort of accord all power, all privileges, all rule in Egypt to the pharaohs. They began to try in various ways to share power. This is also an important period in the elaboration of Egyptian religion. Now, I'm going to turn to the subject of religion specifically and on its own terms in a few minutes. But for right now, what we can say is that emphasis began to move beyond the royal dynasty. In many respects, in the Old Kingdom, Egyptian religion focused on the pharaoh, possibly on some of the members of the pharaoh's family, possibly on some of the pharaoh's closest associates, but fundamentally, religion focused on the pharaoh. In the Middle Kingdom, we begin to see a profusion of gods and goddesses. We begin to see a larger number of sites of temples and temple cults, a large number of priesthoods that began to be more important. So in an interesting kind of way, religion mirrors politics in Middle Kingdom Egypt. A little bit more diffused political control, a little bit more diffused religious experience. Now, when the Middle Kingdom was drawing to an end, the land of Egypt was overrun by